Great. Yeah, thank you very much, Sharif, and thanks very much to the secretaries for the very kind invitation to speak to you all today. And thank you all, also to all of you for coming who are here in person and everyone who's come virtually. So people who are here virtually, can you all hear me? Is that good? Excellent. Excellent. In which case, with your permission, I'm afraid I'm going to make you all disappear so that everyone can see my slides.
This requires a lot of...
There we go. Excellent. Okay. Good. So, yes, thanks once again for being here. So this talk is... based on a paper that should be coming out in BJPS before too long. This paper really started life because I was thinking about the debate between absolutism and comparativism in kind of metaphysics of science, and I was trying to think about what, in some ways, the best possible version of absolutism might look like. And so this is an effort to develop a kind of, broadly speaking, absolutist account of physical quantities. So an account, that is to say, of physical quantities that take seriously the idea that individual magnitudes of physical quantities are meaningful, not just ratios between physical quantities, but deals with some of the concerns that have been raised by comparativists. That's kind of, as it were, the biographical motivation, the causal story behind this paper. A more motivational story, or how I think other people could potentially get interested in this question, comes really from thinking about the structure of quantities. So there's a kind of, first-pass observation that we might make about quantities in science in general, particularly in physics, which is that we tend to use numbers to represent these quantities. We might have a particular weight, and we might use the number 5 to represent the mass of that weight in kilograms. But of course, these numbers have more structure than the quantities that they are supposed to represent. So we could, this is reflected in the fact that the choice of number that you use is to some extent arbitrary. So we could use kilograms to represent the mass of our object, or we could use pounds, in which case we would use the number 11 instead. And this is then going to show up in the fact that, for example, I can take, if I've got a 5-kilogram object and a 2-kilogram object and a 10-kilogram object, here's a fact about the numbers that I'm using to represent those. The product of the first two numbers is the third. 5 times 2 is 10. It's hopefully familiar. But we don't think that that's telling you anything about the quantities themselves, right? So if you were to switch to pounds, then that relationship that if you multiply the first two numbers together, you get the third, isn't going to be reflected in when you use pounds instead. So versions of this worry, I think, show up in Hartree Fields' famous Science Without Numbers, where he points to the role of numbers in science and raises various worries about that. I think Fields' concerns go beyond sort of the concerns I'm going to be worrying about here, because Field, of course, famously is looking for a nominalist formulation, a formulation of physics or of science that doesn't traffic in kind of abstracta at all. My interest in this paper, at least, is really more focused on worries about finding an intrinsic formulation, so a formulation that doesn't make use of more structure than what we think is kind of, in some sense, perhaps out there in the physics, but isn't kind of concerned about using abstracta per se. As will become clear, I'm going to be up to my ears in abstract objects as far as this goes. So that's broadly, what we're trying to do is do our physics intrinsically, so without this extra numerical structure. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to start by describing how you can give an intrinsic account of scalar quantities, quantities like mass or length. Then I'm going to talk, I'm going to use that as a basis for developing an intrinsic account of vector quantities, like momentum or velocity or displacement. And then I'm going to use that apparatus to kind of outline an intrinsic formulation of Newtonian gravitation. So it's a fair bit of ground to cover, but I think we should get through it. I should say perhaps then, in terms of positioning myself, I think one advantage of this approach compared to Fields is that, although I'll be going reasonably quickly, I can, I think, fairly kind of sketch an approach to Newtonian gravitation that's purely intrinsic in, you know, the time we have available together here. Whereas for those of you who've read Science Without Numbers, I mean, it's a short book, but it is nevertheless a book required to kind of build up the apparatus needed in order to get to the same endpoint. And as I say, I mean, that's because Field has set himself considerably more strictures than I have, but I think that's, you know, one advantage of being a bit more relaxed about your restrictions is that I'm able to do things a bit quicker than Field can. Oh, that's the laser pointer, that's why. Good, so let's start by thinking about scalar quantities. And in order to introduce my account of scalar quantities, I'm actually going to need to start by talking about what role I think there is for numbers in physics. Because there are certain contexts and certain places in which it is perfectly legitimate to use numbers in physics, in the sense that the numbers don't represent any kind of commitment to excess structure. And that, as comparativists in the absolutism comparativism debate have kind of noticed, is when you're talking about ratios between quantities, specifically scalar quantities. So if you're thinking about, say, mass ratios, so if I have two weights and I say, well, this weight is twice as massive as this other weight, that is kind of a perfectly legitimate statement. I've used the number two, but there's nothing kind of extra about my choice of two. And I mean, that's kind of reflected in the fact that one weight being twice as massive as another is invariant across changes of units. So it doesn't matter whether I'm using kilograms or pounds or farthing weights or whatever other kind of unit I might want to use, it will remain true that this weight is twice as massive as this weight. There's a kind of more elaborate argument you can give as to why, I mean, essentially, you can sort of show that, provided things are coming in discrete chunks, then it's appropriate enough to use the natural numbers, and then from there you can make a pretty short hop to using rational numbers, and then you can sort of run a continuity argument as to why you would expect mass ratios or length ratios or whatever to have the structure of the real numbers, or at least the positive real numbers, because all of these quantities like mass or length are only going to admit of positive real numbers as their ratios. So, I mean, that means that there's sort of two ways to characterize these numerical quantities. You can just say, well, think about, you know, take the real numbers, axiomatized according to your favorite axioms as a complete ordered field, and then just ignore all the negative ones. If that kind of makes you worried and you already feel like that's kind of, I don't know, committing to all the real numbers, even the ones that you don't need, you can, it turns out, axiomatize the positive real numbers directly as a complete ordered positive semi-field. Just need to muck around with the real number axioms a bit until you find what you want to get the positive numbers. Good. So mass ratios, length ratios, ratios in general, I'll say, are numerical quantities, and they have the structure. So a numerical quantity, like mass ratios, has the structure of the positive real numbers. So that's kind of our starting point. This is where, I mean, the fact that I said I'm not going to be as nominalist as Field is, kind of really becomes clear. And this is probably perhaps the most technical slide in the talk. So I'm going to need for my development the notion of a principal homogeneous space. So here is a small amount of group theory. So we say that a set omega is a principal homogeneous space for a group G if there is a free transitive action of G on omega. So for our purposes, we're not going to actually need to worry too much about what a group is. If you know what a group is in mathematics, brilliant. If not, don't worry about it. The key idea here is that, you know, a group is a kind of structured mathematical set, right? We often talk about groups having actions on sets, which is to say that you can act on one element of the set. So you can take a member of the group, use it to act on some element of the set, and get another element of the set. The characteristic thing about principal homogeneous spaces is that this action has a very particular property. It's free and transitive. What that means is that for any two elements of the set, there is a unique element of the group such that acting on the first element with your group element yields the second element. So the classic example here, so what that means is that given any two members of the set, there's a unique group element that links them. If you like, I mean, I kind of think of this as really just saying a principal homogeneous space is a set equipped with a group-valued binary relation. So it's a binary relation that holds between pairs of objects in the set, but rather than that relation taking, I don't know, the values true or false, as would be the case with a relation that you meet in first order logic, you know, it takes values in the group G. So for example, if you've got a vector space as your group, which forms a group under addition, so a vector space, remember, consists of, you can think of as the collection of arrows from some central point, say for a three-dimensional vector space, it could be the arrows from this microphone out to all points in space, then the corresponding principal homogeneous space is just Euclidean space. Because given any two elements of space, there is a unique vector, a unique three-dimensional vector that goes from the first point to the second. Okay? So it's a little kind of, very brief introduction to group theory. The reason why that's helpful is because I've already told you what the ratios between masses are like. Now I can just kind of help myself to this bit of group theory to get my account of what the masses themselves are like. Because what I'm going to say is that a scalar quantity is a principal homogeneous space for the positive real numbers conceived of as a multiplicative group. So taking the positive real numbers and taking the group operation to be multiplication of positive real numbers, then I'm going to let my scalar quantity be a principal homogeneous space for that group. And what that amounts to saying is that a scalar quantity is a set that has an R plus valued relation on it. So when you take any two members of this set, any two specific scalar magnitudes, there is they stand in a certain relation, call it the ratio relation, the possible values of that relation are the positive real numbers, which is exactly what we want, right? Because we want a mass magnitude, you know, my first mass magnitude and my second mass magnitude to stand in the relation of, for example, being twice as massive as, and so on and so forth. Same for lengths, same for times, same for whatever else. And then, you know, doing this with the apparatus of principal homogeneous spaces is a way of just kind of making sure that all those relations hang together in the way that you would want. So that, for example, if B is twice as massive as A, and C is three times as massive as B, then C is six times as massive as A, and so on and so forth. Good. And basically, kind of the result of all this is that you end up with a space that has the same additive structure as the positive real numbers. So you can add scalar quantities to one another and get another scalar quantity. And it's got the same order structure as R+. So you can say things like this scalar quantity is larger, greater than this scalar quantity, but it does not inherit multiplicative structure. So on R+, there's multiplicative structure like 2 times 3 is equal to 6. There's nothing like that in S, right? Good, which again, just to remind you, is exactly what we wanted. We want to be able to say things like 2 kilograms plus 3 kilograms is 5 kilograms. Good. We don't want to be able to say things like 2 kilograms times 3 kilograms is 6 kilograms. That would be bad. So we've kind of found now a mathematical structure that has precisely as much structure as the scalar quantities and no more. So that is, exactly what we were looking for. So that's good. However, you might have already been worried by this. I just said, well, look, you can't multiply 2 kilograms by 3 kilograms. And you might think to yourself, well, hang on. I can. I'm just not going to get a kilogram as the answer. And that is, of course, true. So now we need to start thinking a little bit about ways in which we can, in fact, multiply and divide scalar quantities by one another. And the trick is that, the key thing is that when you do that, you don't get the same scalar quantity with which you began. So here are ways in which we do this in physics. We might multiply two lengths together and get an area. I might divide a mass by a volume and thereby get a density. So this is the equation for the period of a pendulum. So we've got a whole bunch of algebraic operations being done to various physical quantities in a way that the units kind of all work out appropriately. But the key thing here is that, so when I multiply two lengths together, the key point is that I don't then get another length. That's why the scalar quantities themselves don't carry multiplicative structure. But I do want a way of multiplying two lengths together and getting a length squared, or if you prefer, an area. Similarly, I want to be able to divide a mass by a volume and get a density. Right. So in the interest of time, I'm not going to tell you how to do this. there's a way of kind of setting it up in a way of given kind of three scalar quantities. So I can take a pair of scalar quantities and then I can define a third scalar quantity, which is to be the product of those scalar quantities. Similarly, I can take a pair of scalar quantities and introduce a third scalar quantity that is their ratio. I can talk about how the details of how you do that in the Q&A if you like, but just in the interest of time, just believe me, you can indeed do this. So we now know how to characterize scalar quantities, and we also know how to kind of do algebraic manipulations on scalar quantities, you know, with one another. So that's exciting. So we've rediscovered how to do scalar algebra, but without excess structure. However, we don't just need scalar quantities for doing Newtonian gravitation. We also want vector quantities. So to remind you, this is things like velocity, displacement, acceleration, that kind of thing. So here's how I'm going to define a vector quantity. So I'm going to say that a vector quantity is a vector space equipped with a Euclidean norm, where the norm takes values in some scalar quantity S. So this is a bit of a deviation from, this is basically just taking the normal mathematical definition and putting an asterisk to make everything relate to scalar quantities rather than numbers. So normally in mathematics, you would take, you would model a vector quantity as a vector space equipped with a Euclidean norm. A Euclidean norm is basically a map from the elements of the vector space to the real numbers that obey certain axioms. So I don't have a note of that offhand. It has to be homogeneous. It has to be linear-ish in some way. So, I mean, for example, it has to be homogeneous in the sense that, for example, if I take any given vector and multiply it by 2, then the norm of the doubled vector is twice the norm of the original vector, for example, is what homogeneity means. And there's a couple of other conditions which, I'm not going to lie, I can't remember right now. The important thing about those axioms, though, is that they continue to make perfect sense if you assume that the norm is a map, rather than being a map from the vector space to the real numbers, if you assume instead that it's a map from the vector space to a scalar quantity, those axioms continue to make perfect sense. So, for example, homogeneity says, if I take my vector and I double it, then the norm of the doubled thing had better, the norm of the doubled vector had better be twice the norm of the original vector. That's still fine because I know how to take ratios between scalar quantities. So, kind of everything I need in order to state the axioms and the conditions on something's being a Euclidean norm is still kind of perfectly coherent now that I've working with scalar quantities rather than real numbers. Good. Once you've got this in hand, there's another bit of apparatus that you kind of need, which is the notion of a vector having both a magnitude and a direction. So again, if you think back to kind of high school, when you first learn about vectors, you're told that a vector is a quantity that, unlike a scalar quantity that just has magnitude, a vector is a quantity that has both magnitude and direction. And you can kind of make this precise in this sort of apparatus. I'm not going to go through what the definitions of the magnitude and direction are, but they're very natural. And what they are is the magnitude is going to be an element of whatever whatever scalar quantity your norm is taking values in, which is sort of what you would hope. And the direction is going to take values in a certain quotient space of your vector space, essentially one that is homeomorphic to a sphere of one less dimension than the vector space you're using. That sounds more complicated than it is, but so, for example, if your vector quantity is three-dimensional, then the possible directions of for that vector quantity is like a two-dimensional sphere, i.e. a normal sphere, i.e. kind of what you'd expect, the array of possible directions that a vector in three dimensions could point in, right? So it kind of, again, does more or less what you would expect. Once again, you can, do a certain amount of algebra on this. So a little bit of an extension of the apparatus that I use for multiplying scalars together and dividing scalars by one another enables you to multiply vectors by scalars and to divide vectors by scalars. I don't yet have, I mean, there's, you know, related kinds of things that one often does. So one often, for example, would take a dot product where you would multiply two vectors together to get a scalar. There should be a way of doing that, but I haven't worked out the details yet because I didn't need it for doing Newtonian gravitation and I was running out of words when I was writing the paper. So yeah, it should be doable, but that's kind of a later project. And again, you can kind of take magnitudes and directions, even of these kind of new quantities. So, oh, sorry, I should have perhaps, yeah, clarified. So when one multiplies, if you take a scalar quantity, for example, mass, and multiply it by a vector quantity like velocity, the result is another vector quantity. So in this example, momentum. Similarly, if you divide a vector quantity by a scalar quantity, you get another vector quantity. And the magnitudes and directions of these things behave in more or less the way that you would expect. So if I have, suppose that this is a vector quantity that takes values in some scalar quantity q, and this is just some scalar quantity s, then when I multiply, when I take the product, then the magnitudes of that take values in the product of s with the scalar quantity q. And basically, and similarly for ratios. So essentially the magnitudes sort of all hang together in the way that you would expect. They play nice with the structure, the scalar and vector algebras play nice with one another in the way that you would hope. Perhaps more noticeably, kind of more importantly for what I'm about to do, the direction, so when I, if I start out with some vector quantity, when I multiply it by scalars or divide it by a scalar quantity, then the directions can all be canonically identified with one another. That is going to become important. I mean, I'll talk about this more in a second, but for example, spatial displacements is a vector quantity. As we'll see in a sec, velocities are also a vector quantity that you get by dividing the vector quantity of spatial displacements by an appropriate scalar quantity. Then accelerations is another vector quantity that you get by dividing the velocity vector quantity by another scalar, by a scalar quantity. And those all have the same directions. And what that means physically is that it makes sense to say something like, well, you know, this object's acceleration is in the same direction as its current velocity. Or the acceleration on, you know, for a body that's orbiting in a circle at all times, its acceleration is at 90 degrees to its velocity. We want to be able to say things like that. Those kinds of statements are good. That's prima facie a problem if acceleration and velocity are different vector quantities. But it's okay because although they're distinct vector quantities, their directions are nevertheless comparable. So I mean, I think this is one of the things that I found interesting about this exercise is that putting everything into the real numbers kind of makes everything very comparable. And once you stop doing that and all these quantities are living in their own spaces, it suddenly forces you to attend to the places where you do want to make comparisons between different spaces and between different quantities in a much more careful way than you would do otherwise. Good, so that is kind of the apparatus. Let me now finally just talk about how to then do Newtonian gravitation in a kind of purely intrinsic way, in a way that doesn't make use of the real numbers. So here's the quantities that we're going to need. Unfortunately, there's a surprisingly large number of them. Although, the good, that's the bad news. The good news is that we only need two quantities as primitives, at least for defining motion. So we will start out, we'll have two scalar quantities. One of them will be length and one of them will be duration. I'm then going to introduce two vector quantities, which I'll call spatial displacement and temporal displacement. Spatial displacement is a three-dimensional vector quantity that takes values in length. Temporal displacement is a one-dimensional vector quantity that takes values in duration. So yeah, what that means is that given a spatial displacement, there's a well-posed question of how long is this displacement, and the answer is going to be a certain length quantity, a certain length magnitude. Similarly, for a temporal displacement, there's a question of, well, how much duration does this displacement represent? And the answer will be a certain duration. So that seems good. Then we're going to introduce space and time as affine spaces, that is to say, principal homogeneous spaces, over spatial displacement and temporal displacement. So I kind of already outlined, so this is, you know, strictly speaking, kind of a separate application of this apparatus of principal homogeneous spaces compared to the one I did before, but it's the one that I used as a motivating example for principal homogeneous spaces, so it's, you know, not really new. But this is basically the thing I said, you know, earlier, that so this represents spatial displacements, and this is then going to be kind of points in space. So any two points in space are related by a certain spatial displacement, which has a norm, which is a length magnitude, kind of tracing it back. So that gives us space and time. We also kind of directly introduce a quantity of velocity, which we define as a ratio between the spatial displacement quantity and duration. So we divide a vector quantity by a scalar quantity, get another vector quantity of velocity, and then we do that again. So we now divide velocity by duration to get a quantity of acceleration, again, a vector quantity. So I've now kind of defined up all the kinematic quantities that I need. And so with that in mind, I can now introduce the notion of trajectory. So I mentioned that that for any vector quantity, the space of directions is a sphere of one less dimension than the dimensionality of the vector quantity itself. Delta t, temporal displacement, is a one-dimensional vector quantity. That means we're dealing with a zero-dimensional sphere, which is, it turns out, it's a sphere plus a zero point is what you always get, because there's always kind of the null direction. So in this case, so a zero-dimensional sphere is in fact a two-element set, it turns out, and so we have the two-element set and the zero displacement. So intuitively, this is because there are two directions to time, right? It's essentially what this apparatus has now managed to recover, is that for time there are two possible directions. One of those we might consider past, one we might consider future. Since this theory is going to be time reversal invariant, we don't need to actually worry about which is which, which is also nice. A trajectory for us is going to be a smooth curve from the space of times to from time to space. And then to every trajectory, we can associate not just one velocity, but two, which you might think is more velocities than you need, but that's a product of the fact that I've not differentiated between past and future at this stage. So normally, we just take a velocity to be kind of the future-directed velocity. You could also, if you wanted, work with past-directed velocities. Because I've not designated one of these directions to be past and one to be future, I get kind of two velocities. I just need to specify which direction they're relative to, which direction of time they're associated to. And it kind of, I mean, it comes out in the wash then when you think about accelerations, because it turns out the rate of change of this velocity in this direction is this thing, and the rate of change of this velocity in this direction is also this thing. So whichever direction you choose, you get the same acceleration. Which reflects the fact that velocities change their sign when you do a temporal inversion, but accelerations don't. Good. So now we are going to do the dynamics, not just the kinematics. So I'm going to introduce one more scalar quantity, namely mass. I'm going to define force as a new product quantity, which I get by doing mass times acceleration. So it's also a vector quantity because acceleration is a vector. And now I'm in a position to assert Newton's second law. So I can say that everybody has a mass, a certain mass, a certain trajectory, and a net force such that the force, the net force on that body is equal to its mass times its acceleration. And so this equation is well formed precisely because I defined force as a product quantity of mass and acceleration. Good. However, actually, just before I do this, let me note that this equation is not an analytic consequence of this equation. So I could have, for example, said, well, I'm going to make force be a product quantity, but my statement of Newton's second law is going to be that F is equal to 2ma. And that would still be a perfectly well-formed equation, right? that's significant because that points to the fact that you can kind of introduce further constants beyond what you're required to do in order to make the equation well-formed in terms of units. For the case of Newton's second law, I was able to just state the equation directly without kind of worrying about any constants of nature. That was because I just defined force in such a way as to force Newton's second law to be well-formed. For the law of universal gravitation, I'm not going to be able to do that because all the quantities that are showing up in that equation have already been defined, right? Mass, distance, force, mass, distance, and force. So what that means is that I now am going to be relating a force to a quantity which is the product of two masses divided by the product of two lengths. So this is kind of what the unit is. This is, as it were, the units of force. They're mass times length over time squared. And I want to relate it to something which is a square of masses over a square of lengths. And so on the face of it, Newton's law of universal gravitation looks like it's going to be ill-posed within this apparatus. Again, this is a product of the fact that I'm not just taking things to take values in the real numbers, I'm taking them to take values in these various distinct mathematical spaces. So what that means is I need an isomorphism to exist between these two quantity spaces. And so I'm going to assert that such an isomorphism exists, and I'm going to give it the slightly tendentious label capital G. And the reason we're doing that is because this isomorphism is Newton's gravitational constant, uppercase G, in this apparatus. So constants of nature show up as ways of mapping between distinct quantities in this apparatus. And again, I think, I didn't expect, but it, again, I think sheds an interesting light on what constants of nature are and what they're for. And so this now lets us state the law of universal gravitation. It's going to come in two parts. The gravitational force is a vector quantity. That means I can specify it, provided I'm in a position to specify its magnitude and its direction. So I'm going to give you two laws, two equations, one for the magnitude, one for the direction. The magnitude we get by multiplying the two masses together and then dividing by the square of the distance between them. So, I mean, precisely what we expect from our recollection of Newton's law of universal gravitation. So I form that thing, and then I hit it with my isomorphism G in order to convert it into a force. So that so I need this isomorphism G in order that this equation be, again, well-formed. And then the direction, I just assert that the direction of the gravitational force is the same as the direction of the spatial displacement between the two bodies, right? That if I've got my two bodies like this, then the spatial displacement runs from the first body to the second, and I assert that the gravitational force's direction runs exactly along that line. Note once again, so this is why I emphasized that different vector quantities can, as it were, share a space of directions, because even though this is the direction of a force, and this is the direction of a spatial displacement, because forces are masses times lengths times lengths divided by, no, masses times lengths divided by times times times. So essentially forces are, as it were, cooked up out of spatial displacements, meaning that they share a space of directions. And then kind of final piece of the puzzle, just to sort of close the whole system, is I say that the net force on an object is the sum of the gravitational forces on that object, essentially asserting that there are no forces other than gravity in this theory. Good, and then that theory kind of has the properties that you might want. In particular, it has the property that if I take two solutions and I rescale those solutions by doubling all the masses, the lengths, and the times, then the solution I get as a result is isomorphic to what I started with. That's not the case if I'm setting up my theory using kind of real numbers. So that's kind of why I originally developed this apparatus, is because worries about those kinds of doubling cases is what's motivating a lot of comparativism about magnitudes. And so I think this ameliorates that worry. Good, so, thank you for coming with me on this magical mystery tour. So what to say about this? Satisfies the motivation we started out with. So the quantities introduced don't have any further structure beyond what you can physically motivate, physically realize, physically test. One thing I like about this is that I think compared to Field's setup, it is that bit simpler. There's a bit more kind of group theory and like heavy duty maths doing some of the heavy lifting, but that I think also streamlines things quite considerably because you can just nick results from abstract algebra. It's also, however, quite general. It's, I think, a bit less fine-tuned to the specific case of Newtonian gravitation. So I think extending it to at least something like classical electrostatics, extending it to classical electrostatics is very, very easy because classical electrostatics very closely resembles Newtonian gravitation. Kind of the next thing is to start trying to extend this to more general frameworks. So quantum mechanics, relativistic theories, I mean, even more prosaically, something like fluid dynamics would be a kind of interesting test case because you're going to need bits more apparatus. I need to work, I need to know how to take scalar products. I need to know how to do tensor algebra in this kind of intrinsic way. But that's sort of a project for future work. So I think that's everything I have to say. Yeah, thank you very much for your attention.